Read by John Forrest. Here on FM, Hull West MP, the Right Honourable Alan Johnson, has written a second volume of memoirs, Please, Mr. Postman, chronicling the career that took him to high office as a senior government minister. In a decade of political uncertainty, Alan contemplates the options awaiting him.
It was one Friday night in 1974 in the Slough Supporters Club, a social club opposite the sorting office overlooking the Greyhound track, that my neighbour Mick Pearson and I decided to join the Labour Party. If I had any kind of political epiphany, I suppose this was it. It came in the midst of the period of personal restlessness that prompted me to apply for promotion. I was now an acting postman higher grade. I had also been elected to the Postman's Committee of the Slough branch of the Union, a role that had so far hardly proved arduous since no meetings of the committee ever seemed to be called. Mick Pearson, too, was restless. 10 years my senior and an astute and entertaining companion, he was undergoing something of an early midlife crisis. It had nothing to do with his domestic circumstances, which were happy and stable, and he enjoyed being an ambulanceman. He just wanted more. It would be a pretentious exaggeration to say that he yearned to put his considerable intellect to good use to improve his own lot and that of his fellow man. Suffice it to say, he felt unfulfilled. We talked about politics a lot, Mick and I. Harold Wilson was now back in Downing Street at the helm of a minority government. While we were both Labour voters, neither of us was happy about what we saw as a drift away from its core principles by the party in Westminster. Mick was more focused than I was. He was keen to become a Labour councillor, or at least to do something that gave him an opportunity to have a say and make a difference. I was all over the place politically. I'd read a lot, but analysed very little. I'd got hold of an everyman edition of Das Kapital from somewhere and had read the first volume. I was taken by Karl Marx's view of the struggle between labourers and capitalists as the current stage in an evolutionary process which he regarded as the final phase of humanity's march towards a classless society. I also read the novels of Upton Sinclair and John Steinbeck, as well as devouring the works of George Orwell. At the same time as all this was swimming around in my head, I felt a growing affinity with the Labour movement. My political hero wasn't Wilson, Brown or Crossland, or even Ben, Castle or Foote. It wasn't anyone in the Labour Party. It was the communist leader of the Upper Clyde shipbuilders, Jimmy Reed, a man who'd led his members to the most significant union victory against redundancies, not by going on strike, but by remaining at work. The nine-month work-in ended triumphantly in 1972, and Reed, a charismatic shipyard engineer who'd left school at 14, became a national figure. His famous speech, Alienation, delivered at the University of Glasgow, where students had elected him to be their rector, thrilled me to the core, inspired and moved me in equal measure. It was reproduced verbatim in the New York Times, which described it as the greatest speech since the Gettysburg Address. Jimmy Reed's passions, books, football, music, were my passions. He quoted Burns, Shelley and Shakespeare and was as comfortable in a pub as he was at a seminar. But for all of that, for all my adoration of the man, the Communist Party of Great Britain wasn't for me. I couldn't see how a communist society could ever be a genuinely free society. Totalitarianism, repression of free speech, the burning of books. There was no doubt in my mind that allegiance to the state would eclipse freedom of the individual, which was as important to me as it was to Mike, my conservative voting brother-in-law. If ever I questioned rejecting communism, a development in 1975 reassured me that I had made the right decision. Jimmy Reed had not long after my conversation with Mick Pearson in a supporters club announced his resignation from the Communist Party, and so it was that Alan Johnson, Mick Pearson and Jimmy Reed all joined the Labour Party within a few months of one another. I fell into trade union work like an Arctic explorer into a hot bath. By the end of 1976, I'd revised the branch rules, ensured that all the committees met regularly, set up more robust arrangements for the annual elections, and ensured that the members were better informed about what we were doing on their behalf. The trade union movement wasn't the malevolent force increasingly being depicted by those who had an interest in its demise and no experience of, or need for, its services. At a philosophical level, it was a bulwark against discrimination, a counterweight in the balance of power between employer and employee, and an essential element of a mature democracy. But below the umbrella of these grand ideals was an organised body that delivered meaningful improvements to the working lives of its members. It was not merely a question of giving them a collective voice, but of involving them in the decisions that affected them. By the time I reached my mid-20s, I regretted leaving school at 15. For me, the prospect of going to university had seemed about as realistic as my chances of visiting the planet Pluto, and it had never remotely crossed my mind as achievable. Yet still I thirsted for knowledge. I read constantly, which served only to intensify that thirst rather than quenching it. Becoming a trade union official opened up a whole new world of educational opportunity to me. As branch chairman, I was eligible to attend a range of union training schools. But even more wonderful to me was the cornucopia of TUC correspondence courses available free of charge. I sent off essays and completed exam papers to my tutors through the post, receiving their comments, criticisms, and the occasional commendation by return. It was done for fun rather than to gain qualifications. My tutors got me thinking, studying, and writing. They succeeded in inspiring and encouraging me, even though they had to do so without personal contact and from a distance. So much so that I considered taking up one of the many opportunities to study full-time at Ruskin, the trade union college in Oxford, for which modest grants were available, all funded by the trade union and labour movement. But with a family to support, the finances never worked for me, so I stuck to my correspondence courses, supplemented by evening classes at Slough College, where I reached grade 2 in piano before overtime and the increasing burden of union work took its toll. That year we had told our oldest child, Natalie, about Beppe, her Italian father, who had never sought contact or even been in touch, and I had begun the process of adopting her officially. We said that it would be okay for her to look for Beppe if she wanted to when she was older, but reassured her that I was her father in all the ways that were important. "I wasn't the one who planted the seed that made you," I explained to her, "but I'm the one who loves you and wanted to be your daddy." It's a strange experience, adopting your own child. I had never thought of Natalie as anything but my eldest daughter, and she had never known any other father. The process was rigorous. After the paperwork was completed, social workers interviewed Judy and me together, then separately. Natalie was interviewed with her mother and then on her own. The school had to be involved, and finally we were informed that our neighbours would be interrogated. The truth behind our ambiguous backstory, in which Natalie was presented as the fruit of my 16-year-old loins, was to be revealed. In the event, it didn't matter. None of our neighbours even mentioned it, and I very much doubt that by then it would have been the subject of surreptitious gossip. Around this time, my sister Linda announced her decision to re-establish contact with our father. I was bewildered. He'd beaten our mother, refused to contribute to our welfare, and when I was 8 and Linda almost 11, run off for good to start a new life with the barmaid from the local pub. It was one of the happiest days of our young lives. Linda realised that there was no question of me following her example and having any kind of contact with Steve, our father. I hadn't laid eyes on him since he had turned up uninvited at the cemetery after our mother's funeral, and I had no desire to do so now. It took me a while to understand that Linda's magnanimity was far nobler and humane than my sulky rebelliousness. Her motivation wasn't fondness for the father who treated her far worse than he'd treated me. It was that streak of protectiveness. Steve and his second wife had a daughter together, an only child desperate to establish a relationship with her half-siblings. She became another beneficiary of Linda's endless quest to spread serenity. As 1976 had drawn to a close, we'd spent Christmas with Linda and Mike. Mike was quiet and withdrawn for much of the time. He was keen to get to his newly adopted pub during its very limited festive opening hours. Yet once there, he was unusually gloomy, even morose. He believed the economy was in a mess, he told me. He was afraid that Henry's Radios, where he'd spent his entire working life, would go bust or be sold to new owners. Mike had a close association with the family who owned the business. They had taken him on as a Saturday boy at the age of 13 and treated him like a son. As we drank our pints and smoked his senior service cigarettes, Mike cheered up a little, but on the drive back to Slough, Judy remarked that she too had noticed how distracted and disengaged Mike had seemed. She put it down to overwork. We never saw Mike again. It's difficult to know where to begin, for it had all been building up over a long period but only came to a head in the space of a few short months in 1977. Linda caught Mike unawares, swigging from a bottle of vodka he'd taken out of his briefcase when he thought he was alone. Within minutes, Mike was in tears, admitting that he'd been drinking the stuff surreptitiously for years, since before they'd met over a decade earlier. He had been what would today be known as a functioning alcoholic. Linda reassured him that she loved him as much as ever and that they would get through this dreadful time together. Mike rang home one afternoon in a state of some distress. For a couple of weeks he'd been working alone in a vacant store that Henry's had taken over as an outlet for discounted lines. He'd been drinking at lunchtime. After reopening the shop, he had fallen asleep behind the counter with his suit jacket hanging up beside him. Somebody had come in and stolen his wallet from the inside pocket. All his money and his return rail ticket had gone. Linda told him to ring the police straight away. She checked that Tony, a friend from Alcoholics Anonymous, would be calling for him after work, which Mike confirmed. He would see her later, he said, softly. He told her that he loved her. It was 6 p.m. and Linda was cooking tea for the children when the phone rang. It was Tony asking whether she knew where Mike was. He had gone to the shop as arranged, but the door was locked and the shop was in darkness. Linda was overwhelmed by a sense of dread. "Go back, go back. He must be waiting inside for you," she screamed. She told Tony about the theft and implored him to call the police if he couldn't get into the shop. But by then it was too late. Michael Whittaker, the kindest, gentlest, most decent man I'd ever known, had locked the door of the shop from the inside, drunk a bottle of vodka, descended to the basement, and hanged himself with a piece of electrical cord. Some weeks later, when we cleared Mike's tools from his shed, lifted the hinged lids of bench seats, delved in the attic where he had soldered circuit boards and built speaker cabinets, we found more and more empty vodka bottles. The family doctor disclosed that Mike had been to see her before Christmas about his alcohol problem. Antidepressants had been prescribed after Mike spoke of feeling an urge to jump in front of a train on his way to work. The GP, bound by patient confidentiality, couldn't have shared this information with Linda at the time, but learning it now just led her to castigate herself all the more for having been so completely unaware that Mike had sunk to this level. My sister had been orphaned in her teens and widowed in her 20s. As she entered her 30s that September, 6 months after Mike's death, I could see how determined she was to forge a new life. The last condition to which Linda was likely to succumb was self-pity. But it was hard, so hard for her to go on. It was as if a planet had disappeared from our solar system, leaving an immense black void where once there had been Michael Whittaker.
Please, Mr. Postman was written and read by Alan Johnson. It's a Heavy Entertainment production.
BBC Radio 4 crosses the world online to discover the real-life dramas of strangers.
We foresee a bright future for us. We want to end up together.
The new series of Don't Log Off begins with relationships under pressure.
I said, "Norma, I worked hard to survive, and I deserve my companion in life, and I'm going to help you get through this, and that's what I do."
Don't Log Off, presented by Alan Dean, starting this morning at 11 on BBC Radio 4.